their legs. "Rahel," Amu said, "do you realize what you have just done?" Frightened eyes and a fountain looked back at Amu. "It's all right, don't be scared," Amu said. "Just answer me, do you?"
"What?"
Rahel said in the smallest voice she had. "Realize what you've just done?" Amu said. Frightened eyes and a fountain looked back at Amu. "Do you know what happens when you hurt people?" Amu said. "When you hurt people, they begin to love you less. That's what careless words do. They make people love you a little less." A cold moth, with unusually dense dorsal tufts, landed lightly on Rahel's heart. Where its icy legs touched her, she got goosebumps. 6 goosebumps on her careless heart. A little less her Amu loved her. And so out the gate, up the road and to the left, the taxi stand. A hurt mother, an ex-nun, a hot child and a cold one. 6 goosebumps and a moth. The taxi smelled of sleep. Old clothes rolled up, damp towels, armpits. It was, after all, the taxi driver's home. He lived in it. It was the only place he had to store his smells. The seats had been killed, ripped. A swathe of dirty yellow sponge spilled out and shivered on the back seat like an immense jaundiced liver. The driver had the ferrety alertness of a small rodent. He had a hooked Roman nose and a Little Richard moustache. He was so small that he watched the road through the steering wheel. To passing traffic, it looked like a taxi with passengers but no driver. He drove fast, pugnaciously, darting into empty spaces, nudging other cars out of their lanes, accelerating at zebra crossings, jumping lights. "Why not use a cushion or a pillow or something?" Baby Kuchma suggested in her friendly voice. "You'll be able to see better." "Why not mind your own business, sister?" the driver suggested in his unfriendly one. Driving past the inky sea, Esther put his head out of the window. He could taste the hot salt breeze on his mouth. He could feel it lift his hair. He knew that if Amu found out about what he had done with the orange drink, lemon drink man, she'd love him less as well. Very much less. He felt the shaming, churning, heaving, turning sickness in his stomach. He longed for the river, because water always helps. The sticky neon night rushed past the taxi window. It was hot inside the taxi and quiet. Baby Kuchma looked flushed and excited. She loved not being the cause of ill feeling. Every time a pie dog strayed onto the road, the driver made a sincere effort to kill it. The moth on Rahel's heart spread its velvet wings, and the chill crept into her bones. In the Hotel Sea Queen car park, the sky blue Plymouth gossiped with other smaller cars. Slip, slip. Her snoo snar. A big lady at a small lady's party. Tail fins aflutter. "Room numbers 313 and 327, the man at the reception desk said. "Non-air-conditioned, twin beds, lift is closed for repair." The bellboy who took them up wasn't a boy and hadn't a bell. He had dim eyes and 2 buttons missing on his frayed maroon coat. His grayed undershirt showed. He had to wear his silly bellhop's cap tilted sideways, its tight plastic strap sunk into his sagging dewlap. It seemed unnecessarily cruel to make an old man wear a cap sideways like that and arbitrarily reorder the way in which age chose to hang from his chin. There were more red steps to climb. The same red carpet from the cinema hall was following them around. Magic flying carpet. Chaco was in his room, caught feasting. Roast chicken, chips, sweet corn and chicken soup, 2 parathas, and vanilla ice cream with chocolate sauce. Sauce in a sauce boat. Chaco often said that his ambition was to die of overeating. Mamachi said it was a sure sign of suppressed unhappiness. Chaco said it was no such thing. He said it was sheer greed. Chaka was puzzled to see everybody back so early, but pretended otherwise. He kept eating. The original plan had been that Esther would sleep with Chaka and Rahel with Amu and baby Kuchma. But now that Esther wasn't well, and love had been reapportioned, Amu loved her a little less. Rahel would have to sleep with Chaka, and Esther with Amu and baby Kuchma. Amu took Rahel's pajamas and toothbrush out of the suitcase and put them on the bed. "Here," Amu said. Two clicks to close the suitcase. Click and click. "Amu," Rahel said, "shall I miss dinner as my punishment?" She was keen to exchange punishments. No dinner, in exchange for Amu loving her the same as before. "As you please," Amu said. "But I advise you to eat. If you want to grow, that is. Maybe you could share some of Chaco's chicken."
"Maybe, and maybe not," Chaka said.
"But what about my punishment?" Rahel said. "You haven't given me my punishment." "Some things come with their own punishments," baby Kuchma said, as though she was explaining a sum that Rahel couldn't understand. "Some things come with their own punishments, like bedrooms with built-in cupboards." They would all learn more about punishments soon, that they came in different sizes. That some were so big they were like cupboards with built-in bedrooms. You could spend your whole life in them, wandering through dark shelving. Baby Kuchma's goodnight kiss left a little spit on Rahel's cheek. She wiped it off with her shoulder. "Good night, God bless," Amu said. But she said it with her back. She was already gone. "Good night," Esther said, too sick to love his sister. Rahel alone watched them walk down the hotel corridor like silent but substantial ghosts. Two big, one small, in beige and pointy shoes. The red carpet took away their feet sounds. Rahel stood in the hotel room doorway full of sadness. She had in her the sadness of Sophie Moore coming, the sadness of Amu's loving her a little less, and the sadness of whatever the orange drink, lemon drink man had done to Esther in Abhilash Talkies. A stinging wind blew across her dry, aching eyes. Chaka put a leg of chicken and some finger chips onto a quarter plate for Rahel. "No, thank you," Rahel said, hoping that if she could somehow effect her own punishment, Amu would rescind hers.
"What about some ice cream with chocolate sauce?" Chaka said.
"No, thank you," Rahel said.
"Fine," Chaka said. "But you don't know what you're missing."
He finished all the chicken and then all the ice cream. Rahel changed into her pajamas.
"Please don't tell me what it is you're being punished for," Chaka said. "I can't bear to hear about it."
He was mopping the last of the chocolate sauce from the sauce boat with a piece of paratha. His disgusting after-sweet sweet.
"What was it? Scratching your mosquito bites till they bled? Not saying thank you to the taxi driver?"
"Something much worse than that," Rahel said, loyal to Amu.
"Don't tell me," Chaka said. "I don't want to know."
He rang for room service, and a tired bearer came to take away the plates and bones. He tried to catch the dinner smells, but they escaped and climbed into the limp brown hotel curtains. A dinnerless niece and her dinnerful uncle brushed their teeth together in the Hotel Sea Queen bathroom. She, a forlorn, stubby convict in striped pajamas and a fountain in A Love in Tokyo, he in his cotton vest and underpants. His vest, taut and stretched over his round stomach like a second skin, went slack over the depression of his belly button. When Rahel held her frothing toothbrush still and moved her teeth instead, he didn't say mustn't. He wasn't a fascist. They took it in turns to spit. Rahel carefully examined her white binaka froth as it dribbled down the side of the basin to see what she could see. What colors and strange creatures had been ejected from the spaces between her teeth?
"None tonight. Nothing unusual. Just binaka bubbles."
Chaka put off the big light. In bed, Rahel took off her Love in Tokyo and put it by her sunglasses. Her fountain slumped a little,
but stayed standing. Chaco lay in bed in the pool of light from his bedside lamp, a fat man on a dark stage. He reached over to his shirt lying crumpled at the foot of his bed. He took his wallet out of the pocket and looked at the photograph of Sophie Moll that Margaret Kochema had sent him 2 years ago. Rahel watched him, and her cold moth spread its wings again, slow out, slow in, a predator's lazy blink. The sheets were coarse but clean. Chaco closed his wallet and put out the light. Into the night he lit a charminar and wondered what his daughter looked like now, 9 years old. Last seen when she was red and wrinkled, barely human. 3 weeks later, Margaret, his wife, his only love, had cried and told him about Joe. Margaret told Chaco that she couldn't live with him anymore. She told him that she needed her own space, as though Chaco had been using her shelves for his clothes, which, knowing him, he probably had. She asked him for a divorce. Those last few tortured nights before he left her, Chaco would slip out of bed with a torch and look at his sleeping child, to learn her, imprint her on his memory, to ensure that when he thought of her, the child that he invoked would be accurate. He memorized the brown down on her soft skull, the shape of her puckered, constantly moving mouth, the spaces between her toes, the suggestion of a mole. And then without meaning to, he found himself searching his baby for signs of Joe. The baby clutched his index finger while he conducted his insane, broken, envious, torchlit study. Her belly button protruded from her satiated satin stomach like a domed monument on a hill. Chaco laid his ear against it and listened with wonder at the rumblings from within, messages being sent from here to there, new organs getting used to each other, a new government setting up its systems, organizing the division of labor, deciding who would do what. She smelled of milk and urine. Chaco marveled at how someone so small and undefined, so vague in her resemblances, could so completely command the attention, the love, the sanity of a grown man. When he left, he felt that something had been torn out of him, something big. But Joe was dead now, killed in a car crash, dead as a doorknob, a Joe-shaped hole in the universe. In Chaco's photograph, Sophie Moll was 7 years old, white and blue, rose-lipped and Syrian Christian nowhere. Though Mamachi, peering at the photograph, insisted she had Papachi's nose. Chaco, Rahel said from her darkened bed, can I ask you a question?
Ask me too, Chaco said.
Chaco, do you love Sophie Moll most in the world?
She's my daughter, Chaco said.
Rahel considered this. Chaco, is it necessary that people have to love their own children most in the world?
There are no rules, Chaco said, but people usually do.
Chaco, for example, Rahel said, just for example, is it possible that Amu can love Sophie Moll more than me and Esther? Or for you to love me more than Sophie Moll, for example?
Anything's possible in human nature, Chaco said in his reading aloud voice. Talking to the darkness now, suddenly insensitive to his little fountain-haired niece. Love, madness, hope, infinite joy.
Of the four things that were possible in human nature, Rahel thought that infinite joy sounded the saddest. Perhaps because of the way Chaco said it. Infinite joy, with a church sound to it, like a sad fish with fins all over. A cold moth lifted a cold leg. The cigarette smoke curled into the night, and the fat man and the little girl lay awake in silence. A few rooms away, while his baby grandaunt snored, Esther awoke. Amu was asleep and looked beautiful in the barred blue street light that came in through the barred blue window. She smiled a sleep smile that dreamed of dolphins and a deep barred blue. It was a smile that gave no indication that the person who belonged to it was a bomb waiting to go off. Esther alone walked heavily to the bathroom. He vomited a clear, bitter, lemony, sparkling, fizzy liquid. The acrid aftertaste of a little man's first encounter with fear. Dumb, dumb. He felt a little better. He put on his shoes and walked out of his room, laces trailing down the corridor, and stood quietly outside Rahel's door. Rahel stood on a chair and unlatched the door for him. Chako didn't bother to wonder how she could possibly have known that Esther was at the door. He was used to their sometimes strangeness. He lay like a beached whale on the narrow hotel bed and wondered idly if it had indeed been Relitha that Rahel saw. He didn't think it likely. Relitha had too much going for him. He was a Padawan with a future. He wondered whether Relitha had become a card-holding member of the Marxist Party, and whether he had been seeing Comrade K.N.M. Pillay lately. Earlier in the year, Comrade Pillay's political ambitions had been given an unexpected boost. Two local party members, Comrade J. Kartikaran and Comrade Guhan Menon, had been expelled from the party as suspected Naxalites. One of them, Comrade Guhan Menon, was tipped to be the party's candidate for the Kottayam by-elections to the Legislative Assembly due next March. His expulsion from the party created a vacuum that a number of hopefuls were jockeying to fill, among them Comrade K.N.M. Pillay. Comrade Pillay had begun to watch the goings-on at Paradise Pickles with the keenness of a substitute at a soccer match. To bring in a new labor union, however small, in what he hoped would be his future constituency, would be an excellent beginning for a journey to the Legislative Assembly. Until then, at Paradise Pickles, Comrade Comrade, as Amu put it, had been no more than a harmless game played outside working hours. But if the stakes were raised, and the conductor's baton wrested from Chako's hands, everybody, except Chako, knew that the factory, already steeped in debt, would be in trouble. Since things were not going well financially, the labor was paid less than the minimum rate specified by the trade union. Of course, it was Chako himself who pointed this out to them and promised that as soon as things picked up, their wages would be revised. He believed that they trusted him and knew that he had their best interests at heart. But there was someone who thought otherwise. In the evenings, after the factory shift was over, Comrade K.N.M. Pillay waylaid the workers of Paradise Pickles and shepherded them into his printing press. In his reedy, piping voice, he urged them on to revolution. In his speeches, he managed a clever mix of pertinent local issues and grand Maoist rhetoric, which sounded even grander in Malayalam. "People of the world," he would chirrup, "be courageous. Dare to fight, defy difficulties, and advance wave upon wave. Then the whole world will belong to the people. Monsters of all kinds shall be destroyed. You must demand what is rightfully yours, yearly bonus, provident fund, accident insurance." Since these speeches were in part rehearsal for when, as the local member of the Legislative Assembly, Comrade Pillay would address thronging millions, there was something odd about their pitch and cadence. His voice was full of green rice fields and red banners that arced across blue skies, instead of a small hot room and the smell of printer's ink. Comrade K.N.M. Pillay never came out openly against Chako. Whenever he referred to him in his speeches, he was careful to strip him of any human attributes and present him as an abstract functionary in some larger scheme, a theoretical construct, a pawn in the monstrous bourgeois plot to subvert the revolution. He never referred to him by name, but always as the management, as though Chako was many people. Apart from it being tactically the right thing to do, this disjunction between the man and his job helped Comrade Pillay to keep his conscience clear about his own private business dealings with Chako. His contract for printing the Paradise Pickles labels gave him an income that he badly needed. He told himself that Chako the client and Chaco the management were two different people. Quite separate, of course, from Chaco the comrade. The only snag in Comrade K&M Pillay's plans was Velita. Of all the workers at Paradise Pickles, he was the only card-holding member of the party, and that gave Comrade Pillay an ally he would rather have done without. He knew that all the other touchable workers in the factory resented Velita for ancient reasons of their own. Comrade Pillay stepped carefully around this wrinkle, waiting for a suitable opportunity to iron it out. He stayed in constant touch with the workers. He made it his business to know exactly what went on at the factory. He ridiculed them for accepting the wages they did, when their own government, the people's government, was in power. When Punnachan, the accountant who read Mamachi the papers every morning, brought news that there had been talk among the workers of demanding a raise, Mamachi was furious. "Tell them to read the papers. There's a famine on. There are no jobs. People are starving to death. They should be grateful they have any work at all." Whenever anything serious happened in the factory, it was always to Mamachi and not Chaco that the news was brought. Perhaps this was because Mamachi fitted properly into the conventional scheme of things. She was the Modelali. She played her part. Her responses, however harsh, were straightforward and predictable. Chaco, on the other hand, though he was the man of the house, though he said, "my pickles, my jam, my curry powders," was so busy trying on different costumes that he blurred the battle lines. Mamachi tried to caution Chaco. He heard her out, but didn't really listen to what she was saying. So despite the early rumblings of discontent on the premises of Paradise Pickles, Chaco, in rehearsal for the revolution, continued to play Comrade, Comrade. That night, on his narrow hotel bed, he thought sleepily about preempting Comrade Pillay by organizing his workers into a sort of private labor union. He would hold elections for them, make them vote. They could take turns at being elected representatives. He smiled at the idea of holding roundtable negotiations with Comrade Sumati, or better still, Comrade Lusikuti, who had much the nicer hair. His thoughts returned to Margaret Kochamar and Sophie Moll. Fierce bands of love tightened around his chest until he could barely breathe. He lay awake and counted the hours before they could leave for the airport. On the next bed, his niece and nephew slept with their arms around each other, a hot twin and a cold one. He and she, we and us. Somehow, not wholly unaware of the hint of doom and all that waited in the wings for them. They dreamed of their river, of the coconut trees that bent into it and watched, with coconut eyes, the boats slide by. Upstream in the mornings, downstream in the evenings. And the dull, sullen sound of the boatmen's bamboo poles as they thudded against the dark, oiled boatwood. It was warm, the water. Grey-green, like rippled silk. With fish in it, with the sky and trees in it, and at night, the broken yellow moon in it. When they grew tired of waiting, the dinner smells climbed off the curtains and drifted through the Sea Queen windows to dance the night away on the dinner-smelling sea. The time was 10 to 2. Chapter 5. God's Own Country. Years later, when Rahel returned to the river, it greeted her with a ghastly skull's smile, with holes where teeth had been and a limp hand raised from a hospital bed. Both things had happened. It had shrunk, and she had grown. Downriver, a saltwater barrage had been built in exchange for votes from the influential paddy farmer lobby. The barrage regulated the inflow of salt water from the backwaters that opened into the Arabian Sea, so now they had two harvests a year instead of one. More rice, for the price of a river. Despite the fact that it was June and raining, the river was no more than a swollen drain now, a thin ribbon of thick water that lapped wearily at the mud banks on either side, sequined with the occasional silver slant of a dead fish. It was choked with a succulent weed, whose furred brown roots waved like thin tentacles underwater. Bronze-winged lily-trotters walked across it, splay-footed, cautious. Once it had had the power to evoke fear, to change lives. But now its teeth were drawn, its spirit spent. It was just a slow, sludging green-ribbon lawn that ferried fetid garbage to the sea. Bright plastic bags blew across its viscous, weedy surface like subtropical flying flowers. The stone steps that had once led bathers right down to the water and fisher people to the fish were entirely exposed and led from nowhere to nowhere, like an absurd corbelled monument that commemorated nothing. Ferns pushed through the cracks. On the other side of the river, the steep mud banks changed abruptly into low mud walls of shanty hutments. Children hung their bottoms over the edge and defecated directly onto the squelchy, sucking mud of the exposed riverbed. The smaller ones left their dribbling mustard streaks to find their own way down. Eventually, by evening, the river would rouse itself to accept the day's offerings and sludge off to the sea, leaving wavy lines of thick white scum in its wake. Upstream, clean mothers washed clothes and pots in unadulterated factory effluence. People bathed, severed torsos soaping themselves, arranged like dark busts on a thin, rocking ribbon lawn. On warm days, the smell of shit lifted off the river and hovered over Imanum like a hat. Further inland, and still across, a five-star hotel chain had bought the Heart of Darkness. The History House, where map-breathed ancestors with tough toenails once whispered, could no longer be approached from the river. It had turned its back on Imanum. The hotel guests were ferried across the backwaters straight from Cochin. They arrived by speedboat, opening up a V of foam on the water, leaving behind a rainbow film of gasoline. The view from the hotel was beautiful, but here too the water was thick and toxic. No swimming signs had been put up in stylish calligraphy. They had built a tall wall to screen off the slum and prevent it from encroaching on Karisaip's estate. There wasn't much they could do about the smell. But they had a swimming pool for swimming, and fresh tandoori pomfret and crepe Suzette on their menu. The trees were still green, the sky still blue, which counted for something. So they went ahead and plugged their smelly paradise, God's own country they called it in their brochures, because they knew, those clever hotel people, that smelliness, like other people's poverty, was merely a matter of getting used to, a question of discipline, of rigor and air conditioning, nothing more. Karisaip's house had been renovated and painted. It had become the centerpiece of an elaborate complex, crisscrossed with artificial canals and connecting bridges. Small boats bobbed in the water. The old colonial bungalow with its deep veranda and Doric columns was surrounded by smaller, older wooden houses, ancestral homes that the hotel chain had bought from old families and transplanted in the Heart of Darkness. Toy histories for rich tourists to play in. Like the sheaves of rice in Joseph's dream, like a press of eager natives petitioning an English magistrate, the old houses had been arranged around the History House in attitudes of deference. Heritage, the hotel was called. The hotel people liked to tell their guests that the oldest of the wooden houses, with its airtight, paneled storeroom, which could hold enough rice to feed an army for a year, had been the ancestral home of Comrade EMS Namudripad, Kerala's Mao Zedong, they explained, to the uninitiated. The furniture and knick-knacks that came with the house were on display. A reed umbrella, a wicker couch, a wooden dowry box. They were labeled with edifying placards that said, Traditional Kerala Umbrella, and traditional bridal dowry box. So there it was then, history and literature enlisted by commerce. Kurtz and Karl Marx joining palms to greet rich guests as they stepped off the boat. Comrade Namudripad's house functioned as the hotel's dining room, where semi-suntan tourists in bathing suits sipped tender coconut water served in the shell, and old communists, who now worked as fawning bearers in colorful ethnic clothes, stooped slightly behind their trays of drinks. In the evenings, for that regional flavor, the tourists were treated to truncated Kathakali performances. Small attention spans, the hotel people explained to the dancers. So ancient stories were collapsed and amputated. Six-hour classics were slashed to 20-minute cameos. The performances were staged by the swimming pool. While the drummers drummed and the dancers danced, hotel guests frolicked with their children in the water. While Kunti revealed her secret to Karna on the riverbank, courting couples rubbed suntan oil on each other. While fathers played sublimated sexual games with their nubile teenaged daughters, Putana suckled young Krishna at her poisoned breast. Bhima disemboweled Dushasana and bathed Draupadi's hair in his blood. The back veranda of the history house, where a posse of touchable policemen converged, where an inflatable goose was burst, had been enclosed and converted into the airy hotel kitchen. Nothing worse than kebabs and caramel custard happened there now. The terror was past. Overcome by the smell of food, silenced by the humming of cooks, the cheerful chop-chop-chopping of ginger and garlic, the disemboweling of lesser mammals, pigs, goats, the dicing of meat, the scaling of fish. Something lay buried in the ground, under grass, under 23 years of June rain. A small, forgotten thing, nothing that the world would miss. A child's plastic wristwatch with the time painted on it. 10 to 2, it said. A band of children followed Rahel on her walk. "Hello, hippie," they said, 25 years too late. "What is your name?" Then someone threw a small stone at her, and her childhood fled, flailing its thin arms. On her way back, looping around the Imanam house, Rahel emerged onto the main road. Here, too, houses had mushroomed, and it was only the fact that they nestled under trees and that the narrow paths that branched off the main road and led to them were not motorable, that gave Imanam the semblance of rural quietness. In truth, its population had swelled to the size of a little town. Behind the fragile facade of greenery lived a press of people who could gather at a moment's notice to beat to death a careless bus driver, to smash the windscreen of a car that dared to venture out on the day of an opposition bund, to steal Baby Kachma's imported insulin and her cream buns that came all the way from Best Bakery in Kottayam. Outside Lucky Press, Comrade K.N.M. Pillai was standing at his boundary wall talking to a man on the other side. Comrade Pillai's arms were crossed over his chest, and he clasped his own armpits possessively as though someone had asked to borrow them and he had just refused. The man across the wall shuffled through a bunch of photographs in a plastic sachet with an air of contrived interest. The photographs were mostly pictures of Comrade K.N.M. Pillai's son, Lenin, who lived and worked in Delhi. He took care of the painting, plumbing, and any electrical work for the Dutch and German embassies. In order to allay any fears his clients might have about his political leanings, he had altered his name slightly. Levin, he called himself now, P. Levin. Rahel tried to walk past unnoticed. It was absurd of her to have imagined that she could.
"Are you Rahel Mor?"
Comrade K.N.M. Pillai said, recognizing her instantly.
"Orkunile, comrade uncle."
"Ua," Rahel said. Did she remember him? She did, indeed. Neither question nor answer was meant as anything more than a polite preamble to conversation. Both she and he knew that there are things that can be forgotten, and things that cannot, that sit on dusty shelves like stuffed birds, with baleful, sideways staring eyes.
So, Comrade Pillai said, I think so you are in America now?
No, Rahel said, I'm here.
Yes, yes, he sounded a little impatient, but otherwise in America, I suppose.
Comrade Pillai uncrossed his arms. His nipples peeped at Rahel over the top of the boundary wall, like a sad St. Bernard's eyes.
Recognized? Comrade Pillai asked the man with the photographs, indicating Rahel with his chin.
The man hadn't.
The old Paradise Pickle Kochama's daughter's daughter, Comrade Pillai said.
The man looked puzzled. He was clearly a stranger. And not a pickle eater. Comrade Pillai tried a different tack.
Punyangunya, he asked.
The Patriarch of Antioch appeared briefly in the sky and waved his withered hand. Things began to fall into place for the man with the photographs. He nodded enthusiastically.
Punyangunya's son, Ben Anjonipe, who used to be in Delhi,
Comrade Pillai said.
Uwa, 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 the man said.
His daughter's daughter is this, in America now. The nodder nodded as Rahel's ancestral lineage fell into place for him.
Uwa, 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 in America now, isn't it?
It wasn't a question. It was sheer admiration. He remembered vaguely a whiff of scandal. He had forgotten the details, but remembered that it had involved sex and death. It had been in the papers. After a brief silence and another series of small nods, the man handed Comrade Pillai the sachet of photographs.
Okay then, Comrade, I'll be off.
He had a bus to catch.
So, Comrade Pillai's smile broadened as he turned all his attention like a searchlight on Rahel. His gums were startlingly pink, the reward for a lifetime's uncompromising vegetarianism. He was the kind of man whom it was hard to imagine had once been a boy, or a baby. He looked as though he had been born middle-aged, with a receding hairline.
Maul's husband, he wanted to know, hasn't come.
Any photos?
No.
Name?
Larry, Lawrence.
Ua, Lawrence.
Comrade Pillai nodded as though he agreed with it. As though given a choice, it was the very one he would have picked.
Any issues?
No, Rahel said. Still in planning stages, I suppose.
Or expecting?
No.
One is must. Boy, girl, anyone. Comrade Pillai said. Two is, of course, your choice.
We're divorced. Rahel hoped to shock him into silence.
Divorced?
His voice rose to such a high register that it cracked on the question mark. He even pronounced the word as though it were a form of death.
That is most unfortunate, he said when he had recovered, for some reason resorting to uncharacteristic bookish language. Most unfortunate.
It occurred to Comrade Pillai that this generation was perhaps paying for its forefathers' bourgeois decadence.
One was mad, the other divorced, probably barren.
Perhaps this was the real revolution. The Christian bourgeoisie had begun to self-destruct. Comrade Pillai lowered his voice as though there were people listening, though there was no one about.
And Morn? He whispered confidentially. How is he?
Fine, Rahel said. He's fine. Fine, flat, and honey-colored. He washes his clothes with crumbling soap.
Aiyo paavam,
Comrade Pillai whispered, and his nipples drooped in mock dismay.
Poor fellow.
Rahel wondered what he gained by questioning her so closely and then completely disregarding her answers. Clearly he didn't expect the truth from her, but why didn't he at least bother to pretend otherwise?
Lenin is in Delhi now,
Comrade Pillai came out with it finally, unable to hide his pride. Working with foreign embassies, see? He handed Rahel the cellophane sachet. They were mostly photographs of Lenin and his family, his wife, his child, his new Bajaj scooter. There was one of Lenin shaking hands with a very well-dressed, very pink man.
German First Secretary, Comrade Pillay said.
They looked cheerful in the photographs, Lenin and his wife, as though they had a new refrigerator in their drawing room and a down payment on a DDA flat. Rahel remembered the incident that made Lenin swim into focus as a real person for her and Esther, when they stopped regarding him as just another pleat in his mother's sari. She and Esther were five, Lenin perhaps 3 or 4 years old. They met in the clinic of Dr. Varghese Varghese, Kottayam's leading pediatrician and feeler-up of mothers. Rahel was with Ammu and Esther, who had insisted that he go along. Lenin was with his mother, Kalyani. Both Rahel and Lenin had the same complaint. Foreign objects lodged up their noses. It seemed an extraordinary coincidence now, but somehow hadn't then. It was curious how politics lurked even in what children chose to stuff up their noses. She, the granddaughter of an imperial entomologist, he, the son of a grassroots Marxist party worker. So she, a glass bead, and he, a greengram. The waiting room was full. From behind the doctor's curtain, sinister voices murmured, interrupted by howls from savaged children. There was the clink of glass on metal and the whisper and bubble of boiling water. A boy played with the wooden "Doctor is in, Doctor is out" sign on the wall, sliding the brass panel up and down. A feverish baby hiccuped on its mother's breast. The slow ceiling fan sliced the thick, frightened air into an unending spiral that spun slowly to the floor like the peeled skin of an endless potato. No one read the magazines. From below the scanty curtain that was stretched across the doorway that led directly onto the street came the relentless slip-slap of disembodied feet in slippers, the noisy, carefree world of those with nothing up their noses. Ammu and Kalyani exchanged children. Noses were pushed up, heads bent back and turned towards the light to see if one mother could see what the other had missed. When that didn't work, Lenin, dressed like a taxi, yellow shirt, black stretch-long shorts, regained his mother's nylon lap and his packet of chiclets. He sat on sari flowers, and from that unassailable position of strength, surveyed the scene impassively. He inserted his left forefinger deep into his unoccupied nostril and breathed noisily through his mouth. He had a neat side parting. His hair was slicked down with Ayurvedic oil. The chiclets were his to hold before the doctor saw him and to consume after. All was well with the world. Perhaps he was a little too young to know that atmosphere in waiting room plus screams from behind curtain ought logically to add up to a healthy fear of Dr. V.V. A rat with bristly shoulders made several busy journeys between the doctor's room and the bottom of the cupboard in the waiting room. A nurse appeared and disappeared through the tattered curtain doctor's door. She wielded strange weapons, a tiny vial, a rectangle of glass with blood smeared on it, a test tube of sparkling backlit urine, a stainless steel tray of boiled needles. The hairs on her legs were pressed like coiled wires against her translucent white stockings. The box heels of her scuffed white sandals were worn away on the insides and caused her feet to slope in towards each other. Shiny black hairpins, like straightened snakes, clamped her starched nurse's cap to her oily head. She appeared to have rat filters on her glasses. She didn't seem to notice the bristly-shouldered rat, even when it scuttled right past her feet. She called out names in a deep voice like a man's. A. Nainan, S. Kusumalata, B. V. Roshini, N. Ambari. She ignored the alarmed, spiraling air. Esther's eyes were frightened saucers. He was mesmerized by the "Doctor is in, doctor is out" sign.
A tide of panic rose in Rahel. Amu, once again, let's try.
Amu held the back of Rahel's head with one hand. With her thumb in her handkerchief, she blocked the beadless nostril. All eyes in the waiting room were on Rahel. It was to be the performance of her life. Esther's expression prepared to blow its nose. Furrows gathered on his forehead and he took a deep breath.
Rahel summoned all her strength. Please, God, please make it come out. From the soles of her feet, from the bottom of her heart, she blew into her mother's handkerchief. And in a rush of snot and relief, it emerged. A little mauve bead in a glistening bed of slime. As proud as a pearl in an oyster. Children gathered around to admire it. The boy who was playing with the sign was scornful.
I could easily do that, he announced. Try it and see what a slap you'll get, his mother said.
Miss Rahel, the nurse shouted and looked around. It's out, Amu said to the nurse. It's come out, she held up her crumpled handkerchief. The nurse had no idea what she meant.
It's all right, we're leaving, Amu said. The bead's out.
Next, the nurse said, and closed her eyes behind her rat filters. It takes all kinds, she told herself.
SVS, Kurup.
The scornful boy set up a howl as his mother pushed him into the doctor's room. Rahel and Esther left the clinic triumphantly. Little Lennon remained behind to have his nostril probed by Dr. Verghese Verghese's cold steel implements, and his mother probed by other, softer ones. That was Lennon then. Now he had a house, and a Bajaj scooter, a wife, and an issue.
Rahel handed Comrade Pillet back the sachet of photographs and tried to leave. 1 minute, Comrade Pillet said. He was like a flasher in a hedge, enticing people with his nipples and then forcing pictures of his son on them. He flipped through the pack of photographs, a pictorial guide to Lenin's life in a minute, to the last one.
Orkunando.
It was an old black-and-white picture, one that Chaco took with the Rolleiflex camera that Margaret Kutchmer had brought him as a Christmas present. All four of them were in it. Lennon, Esther, Sophie Moll, and herself, standing in the front veranda of the Imanum house. Behind them, Baby Kutchmer's Christmas trimmings hung in loops from the ceiling. A cardboard star was tied to a bulb. Lennon, Rahel, and Esther looked like frightened animals that had been caught in the headlights of a car, knees pressed together, smiles frozen on their faces, arms pinned to their sides, chests swiveled to face the photographer as though standing sideways was a sin. Only Sophie Moll, with first-world panache, had prepared for herself, for her biological father's photo, a face. She had turned her eyelids inside out so that her eyes looked like pink-veined flesh petals, gray in a black-and-white photograph. She wore a set of protruding false teeth, cut from the yellow rind of a sweet lime. Her tongue pushed through the trap of teeth and had Mamachi's silver thimble fitted on the end of it. She had hijacked it the day she arrived and vowed to spend her holidays drinking only from a thimble. She held out a lit candle in each hand. One leg of her denim bell-bottoms was rolled up to expose a white, bony knee on which a face had been drawn. Minutes before that picture was taken, she had finished explaining patiently to Esther and Rahel, arguing away any evidence to the contrary, photographs, memories, how there was a pretty good chance that they were bastards, and what bastard really meant. This had entailed an involved, though somewhat inaccurate, description of sex. See, what they do is... That was only days before she died. Sophie Moore. Thimble drinker. Coffin cartwheeler. She arrived on the Bombay Cochin flight, hatted, bell-bottomed, and loved from the beginning.
Chapter 6. Cochin Kangaroos. At Cochin Airport, Rahel's new knickers were polka-dotted and still crisp. The rehearsals had been rehearsed. It was the day of the play, the culmination of the "What Will Sophie Maud Think?" week. In the morning at the Hotel Sea Queen, Amu, who had dreamed at night of dolphins and a deep blue, helped Rahel to put on her frothy airport frock. It was one of those baffling aberrations in Amu's taste, a cloud of stiff yellow lace with tiny silver sequins and a bow on each shoulder. The frilled skirt was underpinned with buckram to make it flare. Rahel worried that it didn't really go with her sunglasses. Amu held out the crisp matching knickers for her. Rahel, with her hands on Amu's shoulders, climbed into her new knickers, left leg, right leg, and gave Amu a kiss on each dimple, left cheek, right cheek. The elastic snapped softly against her stomach. "Thank you, Amu," Rahel said. "Thank you," Amu said. "For my new frock and knickers," Rahel said. Amu smiled. "You're welcome, my sweetheart," she said, but sadly. "You're welcome, my sweetheart." The moth on Rahel's heart lifted a downy leg, then put it back. Its little leg was cold. A little less her mother loved her. The Sea Queen room smelled of eggs and filter coffee. On the way to the car, Esther carried the Eagle vacuum flask with the tap water. Rahel carried the Eagle vacuum flask with the boiled water. Eagle vacuum flasks had vacuum eagles on them, with their wings spread and a globe in their talons. Vacuum eagles, the twins believed, watched the world all day and flew around their flasks all night. As silently as owls they flew, with the moon on their wings. Esther was wearing a long-sleeved red shirt with a pointed collar and black drainpipe trousers. His puff looked crisp and surprised, like well-whipped egg white. Esther, with some basis, it must be admitted, said that Rahel looked stupid in her airport frock. Rahel slapped him, and he slapped her back. They weren't speaking to each other at the airport. Chaco, who usually wore a munda, was wearing a funny tight suit and a shining smile. Amu straightened his tie, which was odd and sideways. It had had its breakfast and was satisfied. Amu said, "What's happened suddenly to our man of the masses?" But she said it with her dimples, because Chaco was so bursty, so very happy. Chaco didn't slap her, so she didn't slap him back. From the Sea Queen florist, Chaco had bought two red roses, which he held carefully. Fatly. Fondly. The airport shop, run by the Kerala Tourism Development Corporation, was crammed with Air India Maharajas, small, medium, large, sandalwood elephants, small, medium, large, and papier-mâché masks of Kathakali dancers, small, medium, large. The smell of cloying sandalwood and terry cotton armpits, small, medium, large, hung in the air. In the arrivals lounge, there were four life-sized cement kangaroos with cement pouches that said, "Use me." In their pouches, instead of cement joeys, they had cigarette stubs, used matchsticks, bottle caps, peanut shells, crumpled paper cups, and cockroaches. Red beetle spit stains spattered their kangaroo stomachs like fresh wounds. Red-mouthed smiles the airport kangaroos had, and pink-edged ears. They looked as though if you pressed them, they might say, "Mama," in empty battery voices. When Sophie Maud's plane appeared in the sky-blue Bombay Cochin sky, the crowd pushed against the iron railing to see more of everything. The arrivals lounge was a press of love and eagerness because the Bombay Cochin flight was the flight that all the foreign returnees came home on. Their families had come to meet them from all over Kerala on long bus journeys from Rani, from Kumali, from Viringham, from Uravur. Some of them had camped at the airport overnight and had brought their food with them,
and tapioca chips, and chakavalechida for the way back. They were all there, the deaf Amumas, the cantankerous, arthritic Apupans, the pining wives, scheming uncles, children with the runs, the fiancés to be reassessed, the teacher's husband still waiting for his Saudi visa, the teacher's husband's sisters waiting for their dowries, the wirebender's pregnant wife. "Mostly sweeper class," Baby Kuchma said grimly, and looked away while a mother, not wanting to give up her good place near the railing, aimed her distracted baby's penis into an empty bottle while he smiled and waved at the people around him. "Sss," his mother hissed, first persuasively, then savagely. But her baby thought he was the Pope. He smiled and waved and smiled and waved, with his penis in a bottle. "Don't forget that you are ambassadors of India," Baby Kuchma told Rahel and Esther. "You're going to form their first impression of your country." Two egg twin ambassadors. Their Excellencies Ambassador Elvis, Pelvis, and Ambassador Stick, Insect. In her stiff lace dress and her fountain in A Love in Tokyo, Rahel looked like an airport fairy with appalling taste. She was hemmed in by humid hips, as she would be once again at a funeral in a yellow church, and grim eagerness. She had her grandfather's moth on her heart. She turned away from the screaming steel bird in the sky-blue sky that had her cousin in it, and what she saw was this. Red-mouthed ruse with ruby smiles moved cemently across the airport floor, heel and toe, heel and toe, long flat feet, airport garbage in their baby bins. The smallest one stretched its neck like people in English films who loosen their ties after office. The middle one rummaged in her pouch for a long cigarette stub to smoke. She found an old cashew nut in a dim plastic bag. She gnawed it with her front teeth like a rodent. The large one wobbled the standing-up sign that said, "Kerala Tourism Development Corporation welcomes you," with a Kathakali dancer doing a namaste. Another sign, unwobbled by a kangaroo, said, "Imokliu ot et esips tsaok fo aidni." Urgently, Ambassador Rahel burrowed through the press of people to her brother and co-ambassador. "Esther, look! Look, Esther, look!" Ambassador Esther wouldn't. Didn't want to. He watched the bumpy landing with his tap water eagle flask slung around him and a bottomless bottomful feeling. The orange drink lemon drink man knew where to find him, in the factory in Imanam, on the banks of the Meenachal. Amu watched with her handbag, Chako with his roses, Baby Kuchma with her sticking-out neck mole. Then the Bombay Cochin people came out, from the cool air into the hot air, crumpled people uncrumpled on their way to the arrivals lounge. And there they were, the foreign returnees, in wash-and-wear suits and rainbow sunglasses, with an end to grinding poverty in their aristocrat suitcases, with cement roofs for their thatched houses and geysers for their parents' bathrooms, with sewage systems and septic tanks, maxis and high heels, puff sleeves and lipstick, mixie grinders and automatic flashes for their cameras, with keys to count and cupboards to lock, with a hunger for kappa and mean vevichitha that they hadn't eaten for so long, with love and a lick of shame that their families who had come to meet them were so, so gawkish. Look at the way they dressed. Surely they had more suitable airport wear. Why did Malayalis have such awful teeth? And the airport itself, more like the local bus depot, the bird shit on the building, oh, the spit stains on the kangaroos. Oh, going to the dogs, India is. When long bus journeys and overnight stays at the airport were met by love and a lick of shame, small cracks appeared, which would grow and grow, and before they knew it,
the foreign returnees would be trapped outside the History House and have their dreams redreamed. Then, there, among the wash-and-wear suits and shiny suitcases,